On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
It's obvious that something is happening differently in America. For Christians, we're watching our country turn more and more away from Christian values, embracing not just secular values, but all sorts of things. Dr. Irvin Lutzer is the pastor emeritus of Moody Church, where he served as senior pastor for 36 years, the award-winning author of One Minute After You Die and Hitler's Cross, as well as a featured speaker on three radio programs heard on more than 750 national and international outlets. His newest book is We Will Not Be Silenced, Responding Courageously to Our Culture's Assault on Christianity. It's from Harvest House Publishers. We're delighted to welcome Dr. Lutzer back to On the Bookshelf. It's been a while since we've talked, and I'm very excited to get a chance to talk to him, particularly about this book.
I'm so glad that I can be with you today, Dave, and we live in some very critical times, and we have to speak to those times.
The reason that you wrote the book has to do with your concerns about the direction of the country, correct?
Yeah, you know, I began to realize that the radical left in America does not believe that America can be fixed. It has to be destroyed and then rebuilt upon a Marxist foundation, cultural Marxism. Now, cultural Marxism is different than classical Marxism. Classical Marxism was primarily economic, and of course, for the state to take over everything and own everything and to take the place of God, it necessitated some terrible revolutions in Russia and China. Cultural Marxism says we can bring about a Marxist state incrementally if we capture the media and law and education, if we vote for the right people. It can be brought in bit by bit, but the past has to be vilified so that we have a good reason to build this new future. So in the minds of many people, what we need to do is to trash our Judeo-Christian heritage, and that is done largely because of racism and, of course, the sin of slavery and all that. We have to trash it all because we have a better foundation upon which we're going to build the future. So what I do in the book, Dave, is to show how cultural Marxism is applied to our history, why it is that you have this attack against Judeo-Christian heritage, how it is used to foment race relationships. This is very critical. The fact that you see the kind of thing that happens on television every day, that is very intentional, not to bring about reconciliation or even resolution, but perpetual conflict. I hope we get a chance to talk about that. And then how it applies to freedom of speech, how it applies to propaganda, the destruction of the family, and so forth. Once you understand what the goal is and what the underlying philosophy is, everything begins to fall into place, and you can watch the news and see it happen right in front of your eyes.
I was reading another book recently, and I had just finished your book. It's called Soviet Soft Power in Poland, Culture and the Making of Stalin's New Empire. And as I started reading it, I realized that the very techniques that the Soviets were using to interface with the Polish communist in trying to set up the country to be taken over after World War II was finished were eerily like the techniques that were being used to paint the United States as a terrible place, much as the Project 1619 does, that America's always been bad, 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 and the only way to fix it is to rip everything down to the grassroots and start over again. And I begin to realize this is exactly what you were talking about in your book.
You know, since we're talking about that, in my book what I do is I talk about cultural and cultural demonization, collective demonization, that's the phrase. And that actually was perfected in the Soviet Union. Since you bring up the Soviet Union, here's what it means. When the state decided to vilify somebody and deplatform them, everyone else had to chime in. Even people who knew nothing about the person, knew nothing about what he believed, wanted to show that they are indeed on board. And in Nazi Germany, you mentioned that I happen to have written a book about Nazi Germany, Hitler's Cross.
Mm-hmm.
In Nazi Germany, you had churches that put the swastika in their churches or even on their door, saying that when you come for the Christians, don't come for us because we are on your side.
Mm.
Just like some people, you know, put up Black Lives Matter signs. And by the way, since I'm talking about that, of course, Black Lives Matter, all Black Lives Matter. We had two teenagers shot here in the city of Chicago just the other day. Those Black Lives Matter. But the organization that takes that mantra is Marxist. And on their website, they had that they believe in the dissolution of the family. Now, why do they believe that, Dave? It's because in Marxism, the family is a unit of oppression. Men oppress their wives, you know, parents oppress their children, they take them to church, God is the ultimate oppressor. And that's how come you have racism today where you divide people up. But back to collective demonization. What that means is, and we've seen it before our eyes, is that if the All-Star Game is moved from Georgia to somewhere else, everyone has to chime in, Coca-Cola, you know, the airlines, Delta, we're all on board. And the question that people are asking today is, am I woke enough to be thought of as virtuous? So what you try to do is you divide people, you're virtuous, I'm virtuous, you're not, and what we have to do is to set up that conflict, and everyone has to chime in. That's very, very important. By the way, I can't help but tell the story that, according to Solzhenitsyn, when Stalin was giving a speech in 1937, everyone jumped to their feet, and they clapped 5 minutes, 6 minutes, 7 minutes. By 9 minutes, some of them were almost collapsing themselves. They kept clapping until a man who was the head of a paint organization, a painter, sat down. Thankfully, everybody followed him. Later on, he was tried, and he was given 10 years in prison. And he was told, don't ever be the first person who stops clapping.
Mm.
So what you have in today's society is this desire to make sure, I don't want to be the first one to stop clapping.
Right.
When the clapping goes, everyone has to chime in.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, to Dr. Erwin Lutzer, who is the author of We Will Not Be Silenced, Responding Courageously to Our Culture's Assault on Christianity. It's from Harvest House Publishers. This cultural Marxism, it just seems to be getting more and more pervasive, and there are lots and lots of ways, lots of techniques that they're using in areas of attack. You mentioned the destruction of the schools, so the embracing of aberrant behavior, and everybody is trying to jump on the bandwagon faster than somebody else to say, I'm more woke than they are because we got on this train first. Things that are being advocated now in schools, no one would have imagined these things decades ago, except for the people who have been slowly building this technique and slowly building this ideology behind the scenes for all these years.
Well, let's begin with Saul Alinsky here in Chicago, a community organizer during the 1970s. He was a committed Marxist, and I happened to meet somebody who worked with him. And he said Saul Alinsky was not interested in solving problems. He said that, this man told me, he said, we had some good plans to help under-resourced communities here in Chicago, and Saul Alinsky blocked them. Because he said, don't solve problems, use them. So what he decided to do is to take principles of Marxism and apply it to race.
Hmm.
Because he could see then that you could have perpetual conflict. And that's why, as I already hinted just a few moments ago, Marxism was based on this idea of oppression. So in Marx's mind, there were two different kinds of people. There was the proletariat, and they were being oppressed by the bourgeoisie. And the Marx says that the goal is that the proletariat, the oppressed, overcome their oppressors. So let's apply this to race today. You have two different groups. The whites generally believe to be the oppressors, and then you have the oppressed. And what you have to do is to bring them into constant conflict. The intention is that eventually the oppressed will have cultural dominance over the oppressors. And so what you do is you cannot solve problems. I mean, all these diversity studies in the university are not intended to solve anything. They are intended to flame and to blame and to bring about the kind of conflict that is so prevalent in our society, and on and on. And there's no end to it. That's why, you know, after you have the verdict that was handed down to the police officer in Minneapolis, where he was found guilty of murder on all three counts, this does not in any way end anything, because you cannot end it. It is intended to keep on going, and there's nothing that can be done that will ever be enough. Now, having said all that, think of what Christianity says to this. Christianity has the answer. Christianity says, you know, the differences between us aren't that great. We're all created in the image of God. We are all sinners. We come to Jesus Christ. We receive forgiveness. We are reconciled. And then we begin to ask the question, what can we do to make things better? But we don't have to keep shouting at one another across racial fences. We don't have to always keep up the blame game. We can actually move forward. And that is totally contrary to what you have in universities today. To put it very simply, Christianity says that we do not really have a skin problem. We have a sin problem. Mm. So let's deal with that. And by the way, I know that the left believes that African Americans cannot be racist, only whites can be. And, you know, there's plenty of evidence to dispute that. We shouldn't be putting people into these camps and branding them. But that's what Marxism does. And once you're in one of those camps, there's no way to get out. I don't want to belabor this too much, but let me say this. If you're a white, even if you're born into the most poor home imaginable, you are still a person of privilege. If you're LeBron James, you are not a person of privilege, despite the millions of dollars, because of the color of your skin. So the intention is to destroy individuality, to put people into various camps, either as oppressors and oppressed, and that's the intention. Now, I've been talking a long time, Dave, but I'm going to talk a little longer, and then
okay.
I'll get you to ask another question.
Yeah, you're doing fine.
Let's apply this now to freedom of speech. In the 60s, there was a Marxist by the name of Marcuse, and Marcuse said, if we allow freedom of speech, the capitalists would win. Because remember, the capitalists are the oppressors, and oppressors always take advantage of their advantage, okay?
Right.
So the only way that we can bring about Marxism incrementally is to say that it is time for the oppressed to speak, and the oppressors have to keep their mouths shut. So that's the way in which it is being applied today. So you look at the universities, conservatives who are seen as the oppressors are not invited to speak. It is time for the oppressed to speak, the LGBTQ community. And by the way, you had better get on board, because if not, you'll be left behind, you will be vilified, and so forth. And so that's why freedom of speech is so curtailed today and so under attack, because after all, if you allow it, the oppressors win. So let's shut them up. And while I'm on the topic, since you're being so gracious to me, I also have a chapter in my book, and as you mentioned earlier, the name of the book is We Will Not Be Silenced. I have a chapter on propaganda. Now, the purpose of propaganda is to so shape people's view of reality that even when confronted with a mountain of evidence, they will not change their minds. And so that propaganda is promoted by collective demonization, which I already referred to. But there are two emotions that become very important in propaganda. One is hate. Hate unifies people. Hitler said that. Hate is more powerful than mere dislike, Hitler said. And so what you have to do is hate. And of course, for him, it was the Jews, originally the communists, and so forth. What you have to do is to foment hate, very important, And then fear if you step out of line. And so if you step out of line, you are deplatformed, you no longer fit, and as a result of that, you have a lot of backlash. Of course, under strict communism, you're taken to a concentration camp or to a, or a jail or whatever. But the point is that propaganda is very powerful. Gaslighting, that's a term I had to look up when I wrote my book and find out what that is all about. That is where you are supposed to totally deny reality and come up with a narrative that fits an ideology. And that's why you have all of this business of pronouns. You know, are you a they or a them or a he or a she or something in between? Because the purpose, and certainly George Orwell made this clear, the purpose is to so confuse people that they remain silent. Because you don't know, you might call somebody a he who wants to be called a she, and on this goes. Again, it's back to Karl Marx, who indicated that chaos was necessary to bring about a revolution, and you can really believe today that we have chaos.
So the question that I'd like to ask is, what do we as Christians do about the radical homosexuals, the redefining of sexuality and all of that? What can we do about that in order to not feed the fire that they are saying we're a people of hate or we're a people of intolerance? How do we do an end run around that and tell the truth to people?
Well, you know, that's the task of the church. By the way, I wrote my book, and in the intro, since you read it, you'll have read this. I didn't write it to reclaim the culture. I wrote it to reclaim the church.
Right.
Because the reality is we might not be able to change the culture. I mean, there are certain cultural streams. I don't foresee the day in America when we can reverse same-sex marriage, for example, and some of the transforming cultural streams that we have to deal with. So the question is, if we cannot change the culture, is the culture changing us? Or are we standing against the culture with love, definitely, but also with drawing a line in the sand and saying with Luther, here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, so help me God. Let me give you an example of the kind of problems and the lines that have to be drawn in the sand. Here in Chicago, at the Moody Church, a man who teaches in the Chicago school system told me that he was told it is not enough for you to simply tolerate same-sex marriage. If you don't celebrate it, you could lose your job. All right, now, is he going to celebrate what God has condemned? No. Will he lose his job? I'm not sure. But Dave, here's the question. If he does lose his job, do other Christians, does the church have his back? Does the church say, you know what we need to do? We need to stand with this brother who lost his job because of his integrity and his Christian witness, because times are tough, and one of the things that you learn under a totalitarian regime is that Christians have to hang together. Now, we've not had to do that in America because we've always had governments that were somewhat favorable to our freedoms and Christianity and so forth. But as that changes, we're going to have to make some hard decisions. We're going to have to draw some lines in the sand, even if we don't change the culture, and possibly we cannot. But as I frequently tell people, it is not necessary for us to even have freedom to be faithful. You just have to ask the martyrs. Now, in the last chapter of my book, We Will Not Be Silenced, in the last chapter, I have a chapter entitled Strengthen What Remains. It's actually the words of Jesus to the church in Sardis. And what he says is, you have a reputation of being alive, but actually you're dead. I can't find a heartbeat. But strengthen what remains. And I say to people, you may not be able to change your circumstances or your school, though we should work to do that and work together to do that. But when the decision needs to be made, you have to make a decision to keep your integrity and your Christian faith and your loyalty to Christianity. But you also have to learn to take the consequences, which might be losing your job. I mean, can a Christian, for example, write a letter of apology for having been born white? I don't think so. So you're going to have to take a stand. And for all those listeners who were with us from the beginning when I told the story about Stalin and the people clapping on and on, are you going to continue to clap? Or are you going to stop clapping and take the consequences?
It seems to me that the most complicated part about being a Christian today in America is that, as you put it, we've had a government that's been either sympathetic or encouraging of Christianity since the inception. And that for the first time, we seem to find ourselves in sort of, not trying to draw too tight a parallel here, kind of like the early church, where there's increasingly a remnant, and the people that are in the church have to decide if we're going to take our faith seriously, despite whatever physical consequences there might be. Before, we didn't really have to worry about being persecuted for our faith, but if we are, we have to be willing to do that, because the alternative is just to roll over and give up. It's Christ in culture being rediscovered all over again.
You know, I marvel at the Apostle Paul. Of course, he wasn't married, as far as we know. I don't think that, obviously, he didn't have a family, so he can talk more freely. But there he is in prison, and he writes the letter to the Philippian church, and he doesn't even ask them to pray that he will be out of prison. He says, I'm a prisoner for Christ, etc., in the prison epistles. Because he saw suffering for Christ as a badge of honor. And we, of course, complain, and we as Americans think to ourselves, this shouldn't be happening to us, you know, because we are Americans after all. But we're going to have to rethink that. We're going to have to rethink of what it means to stand up for Christ and take the consequences. And that, I think, is very important. And I want to add a footnote here regarding the whole business of Christians submitting to the culture under the guise of love. One of the things I mention in the book is that love can be evil. When Adam and Eve sinned in the garden, they didn't stop loving. They just started to love the wrong things, lovers of pleasure, lovers of self, lovers of money. So just because you have two men who may, quote, love each other, that does not give them the right to be married. And by the way, that legal decision by the Supreme Court was really, really seriously problematic, but that's another matter. But the point is that you cannot say, oh, they love each other, so they have a right to be married. No, love can be very deceptive. So the church needs to think that through, too, so that we hold the truth in love, but it has to be biblical love. Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. That's a different kind of love.
In that last chapter, you talk about another book that you read called Shameless, and you react to that, and you say that biblically, shame is taken away not by burning the teachings of the Bible about homosexuality, but by acknowledging the wonder of God's gracious forgiveness and cleansing given to all who repent of their immorality. And I would say, and no matter what that immorality is, because there's plenty of realization to go around that we are all have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So what we bring to the world is, here's hope. There's grace available. There's forgiveness available. And like the psalmist says, God, once he forgives us, throws our sins as far away as the east is from the west.
And, you know, in my book, what I do is at the end of every issue, about 10 different issues or so, I always have the response of the church, whether it's the vilification of our history, struggles regarding race, you know, even issues regarding the sexualization of children. What my burden is, and I think it's yours too, is to help us to think through how we can respond biblically to a culture that has lost its way. To be able to speak and to not be co-opted by the right nor to the left, but to speak in such a way that people who have ears will listen. Many won't, but we're not responsible for those, but we are responsible to be faithful. And faithfulness is something that the church in America is clearly going to have to relearn, because the church has needed to learn that throughout the centuries, and we are relearning it right now.
That last chapter, you talk about the church at Sardis, and I want to reiterate that, to strengthen what remains, to build on the hope and the grace of God, to stand firm, and to not be willing to be rolled over just so we don't offend anybody or get into trouble. I think that's a message that the church desperately needs to hear and to embrace right now in America.
Exactly. And let me encourage people, would you remember that God did not abandon his sovereignty even if our favorite candidate was not elected? What we need to do is to recognize that God is with us to walk through these cultural moments where you have the convergence of issues such as COVID, you have political wrangling, you have racial wrangling, you have opposition, you have people who are outraged by everything and every little thing, you have absurdity. And by the way, I talk in my book about transgenderism and some of the absurdities that are connected with that. But Dave, let's remember that absurdity in our era is no longer an argument against anything.
Mm.
So what we have to do is to hold our ground, to speak lovingly. When shouted at, we don't shout back, but we do speak.
Dr. Erwin Lutzer, our guest today on the bookshelf, his newest book, We Will Not Be Silenced, Responding Courageously to Our Culture's Assault on Christianity. It's from Harvest House Publishers and available online and in bookstores everywhere. Dr. Lutzer, do you want to mention a website or anything as well?
Well, you know, they can go to Amazon, they can go to Christian Books, which is having a sale on We Will Not Be Silenced. If there are those who are listening who'd like to help us with our media ministry, for a gift of any amount, we'll send the book to them. They can go to MCM Offer. Now, MCM stands for Moody Church Media. MCM Offer. That, of course, is all one word. MCMOffer.com. That's another way that they can get the book, We Will Not Be Silenced.
And that's offer like O-F-F-E-R, not author like...
Yeah, that's right. O-F-F-E-R. MCM Offer.
Dr. Lutzer, it's been an honor to have you on the show again. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us and to do such an excellent job in talking about your book, which is powerful. And like Dr. David Jeremiah has said, if I could, I would put this book in the hands of every Christian in America. May that be so.
God bless you.
Yes, sir. God bless you. Okay. And thank you again. Yeah. And once again, you can go to christianbooks.com or mcmoffer.com. Our thanks once again to Dr. Erwin Lutzer for being with us on the bookshelf again today. And we'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station. Also, check out my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com and our Facebook page on The Bookshelf with Doc. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.